subsume all kinds of different knowledge under a single banner and has expertise that is generalizable, sees fundamental principles among things, and is able to relate disparate fields to one another. I think that's an aspiration that's a value worth valuing, right? The relationship between disparate fields. So it's not so much that kind of character that Nathan is criticizing. In fact, I find it interesting that there is almost a tone throughout the paper where Nathan has this idea of the kind of character or the kind of person that is a typical, like a prototypical epistemic trespasser. And I'm not going to like ascribe to Nathan anything, but he does seem not like bitter, but he does have like an investment in speaking out against these kinds of people, right? He even has an autobiographical note about people who dismiss Gettier problems. You know, he says, as an epistemologist, I find it really frustrating that people just dismiss Gettier problems. But that's a little, that's a personal, but that's totally fine. And I like that that's there. This is not a dry paper at all, even if it is technical. But the kind of character that he's talking about is that, first, the intellectual character of trespassers often looks unsavory, out of their league, but highly confident nonetheless. Trespassers may appear to be immodest, dogmatic, or arrogant. Trespassers easily fail to manifest the trait of intellectual humility and demonstrate one or another epistemic vice, right? That's why I think that the case studies at the beginning are really important to show the phenomena that he's talking about. Linus Pauling is the one good case, but I think philosophers and philosophy students will be more familiar with Richard Dawkins and Neil deGrasse Tyson, who he raises in the beginning. Richard Dawkins is a famous to the point of notorious anti-theist, arguing for arguing against the existence of God and whatnot, often with less than sympathetic arguments, ones that even if we are atheistic or anything like that, should find unsavory and not representative of like what an honest discussion about that stuff looks like.
Well, yeah, and there's definitely a kind of situation of like throwing the baby out with the bathwater with someone like Dawkins, because like, well, you know, his whole argument and stuff might be based off, one, I'm an evolutionary scientist, and two, there's no proof for God, therefore, like, I'm an atheist, and like religion is bad. Like, I think, you know, Nathan would point out that like, you know, religious studies and religious life is more than just a yes or no determination on the existence of some God or other, right? Like there's a whole lot of other stuff culturally, socially, personally, world construction wise going on. And like Dawkins doesn't understand that or doesn't think it's relevant, right? Like, and so that's just kind of that tendency to skip things over. And I wanted to say that, like, Ethan points out that this is, like, a historical problem. I really like how he points out that actually, like, epistemic trespassing as an issue was brought up by Plato and, in extension, Socrates in the Apology. He writes, you know, in Plato's Apology, Socrates tells us he tracked down citizens in Athens who had reputations for being skilled. He met politicians, poets, and craftsmen and tested their mettle. As Socrates says, he found those who had the highest reputation were nearly the most deficient. One thought himself very wise in most important pursuits, and this error of theirs overshadowed the wisdom they had. So this is, again, talking about the same issue, but also pointing out how, those with the highest reputation, those with like the most fame, the most accolades, you know, those were the people who were often the most wrong, because they let like what they did have in terms of knowledge overshadow what they didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, there is this question when someone becomes publicly successful about what kind of skills they have. Crowds are crowds, right? Crowd is a single beast, and they they are appealed to by the same things. I think that's why Plato is so prescient. If one becomes successful in a crowd, it's because one's appealing to it and not necessarily because one is exercising intellectual modesty or being particularly observant or correct about particular opinions, right? If you're putting your efforts into succeeding with a crowd, well, you've only got, you know, a finite amount of energy. You're gonna, if you're putting it in that one thing, you're probably neglecting the actual intellectual part of it, right? Or you're even like actively neglecting it as far as throwing intellectual honesty under the bus when it would jeopardize success and reputation or status.
Yeah, and I think this is even more prevalent, maybe. I think going back to the question of like media, epistemic trespassing is really rife in the world of online intellectual guruism and stuff like that. I mean, the person that I immediately thought about when we was reading through this paper was Jordan Peterson, right? Like, that's a great example of someone who was like pretty well respected and well known in their specific field and area of psychology, then, you know, became a public intellectual and suddenly had very forceful opinions on it, like every subject you could possibly ever bring up to them, right? Like, it always has something, you know, kind of absolute and final and definitive to say on every single subject. And it's like, how could he possibly know?
It's interesting too. Like, I guess the case of Peterson is interesting because the way, like, you have to, if you're going to be an epistemic trespasser, you do have to establish your credibility in one particular field. And I think the way that he did that was through his various videos that he posted, usually lectures and whatnot, that established him as, you know, a credible source of information in his respective domain. I mean, he was an accredited student of, like, these particular fields. He was even like a practicing psychotherapist, as far as I know, like in the Jungian school most particularly. That's all well and good. It's interesting to think on terms of like, okay, well, something must have happened where either, and this is an interesting question to think on too, like either Peterson or his audience believed that his psychotherapeutic background made him a credible authority on figures beyond his, you know, psychotherapeutic background. Sure, on the one hand, we might think that Peterson thought this, and then he went out and started saying all of these things. But under the media conditions that we exist in now, I almost wonder if it's almost as relevant a question to wonder how responsible the audience is for trying to take up that information and thinking that they can apply it to all kinds of different problems. The belief that the audience themselves thought that this made him a relevant authority on other matters gave Peterson the license to think that he could think of other things.
Experts on a public stage are cast in the role of public intellectual or celebrity academic. They may find trespassing all but impossible to resist. And I think that kind of gets exactly what you're saying up there, which is as soon as an expert starts to sort of leave their field, and especially if they're sort of rocketed up by fame, celebrity, and like worship that comes along with that kind of celebrity status, they almost have to trespass, and they almost feel a duty to trespass. And like, you know, it's sort of like their ego gets inflated, but also their purview of what they're going to have to talk about and seem smart and correct about is also going to get exaggerated. And so they kind of have to fill that space. And it's not like Peterson or any other kind of public intellectual actually has the time to reaccredit themselves in every field that they're going to be talking about. So instead, they just epistemically trespass and talk confidently and rely upon the accolades that they already have to justify the new things that they're saying. It does work on a little bit of a feedback loop, especially when you get to the celebrity intellectual model.
And especially considering that, because I think you were like expressing a little bit of hesitation in terms of like, you know, have things really changed? I don't think so, things have fundamentally changed, but the present media conditions certainly are an accelerant to like a situation that has always existed, right?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, and I think that that's just, it's, you know, there's just more people asking you, especially if you're in that position, there's more people asking your opinions on more stuff. And there's also a certain degree of like internal congruency that you have to have. If you're a expert on some level, and being an expert doesn't mean you know 100% of everything. It's not like Peterson is just the, you know, ontological god of psychology. But at least at one point, he was a relatively well-respected and well-known psychologist. He had certain worldviews, had certain perspectives, had certain, you know, domains of psychology. Now his expanding area of commentary has to also fit with his actual area of expertise on some kind of level, right? So everything ends up kind of getting filtered through their like specific zone. Like another example from earlier would be like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who, you know, is like Mr. like rational natural scientist kind of guy. And he hates philosophy, right? Because in his mind, he turns philosophy into something that's unscientific because that's how he thinks about it, right? Like, and so it's sort of self-perpetuating that you're just going to epistemically trespass and inevitably be wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. With the case of Neil deGrasse Tyson, I've always seen his remarks as just being scientistic in terms of like, okay, well, a smart person going to study philosophy is just a wasted scientist, right? You could have been doing science, but you instead had to flub it and study philosophy. I think that that's more how I like interpret what he says, because I think that what you're talking about previously is kind of right, that he has to see it through the, like, he has to see his, like, the other field, like, transferred through or filtered through his own field. And he just sees philosophy as, like, not, it's just, like, bad astrophysics, I guess, or, like, bad science. The case of Neil deGrasse Tyson, Stephen Hawking was like this as well. He thought that philosophy was useless. The other interesting case of this is Bill Nye, the science guy, if you will. He was one of the kind of like philosophy detractors, but he had an interesting moment where he went and he listened to the people kind of saying like, hey, you know, philosophy isn't so useless. It's not so bad. You should go read it. And he did. And he changed his opinion. I think it's interesting, though, because his opinion of philosophy changed, but the framework from which he approached it didn't necessarily change. Like, he thought that philosophy might have scientific value after the fact, but that's not to necessarily start valuing philosophy. Even though you exercise a certain kind of apparent modesty, it still maintains the conditions for epistemic trespassing. Like, this is actually just a case of trespassing onto philosophy and imposing values within your field onto the other field.
Trespassing can also harm other people, obviously. Public intellectuals, bystanders may be led into error when they trust the word of trespassers. The genuine experts may expend precious resources refuting trespassers' mistakes or managing PR campaigns to correct dangerous misinformation. Yeah, so I think that the like epistemic trespassing is, there's this aspect of it. Being, not only is it like logically wrong, epistemically, you know, not knowledge, it's also, there's a kind of a moral component here where, especially if you have an audience, you're leading people astray and you're also forcing actual experts in any given field to waste their time dealing with your trespassing on their turf.
Yeah, you sort of jam up the works, as it were. You have to do some kind of like a handiwork afterwards to repair damage that gets done. I can absolutely see it in other kinds of like scientific cases, where especially where there are things like evidence and skills that are involved in interpreting and presenting evidence that are just completely trampled on by trespassers.
He goes through and he says, like, you know, within the actual terms, there's fields and there's experts. He said a field is fixed by a set of questions or topics. For instance, the question of biochemistry, the study of chemical substances and processes in living things makes up a field. He says that expertise is a status of thinkers, and it is a relative to a field at a particular time. Let us say thinkers count as experts in a field only if they possess two things at one time. And this is actually really important. First, enough relevant evidence to answer reliably or responsibly their field's questions. And second, enough relevant skills to evaluate or interpret the field's evidence as well. Particularly within the question of, like, obviously we can kind of think about what fields are. There's basically fields of interest, and they're kind of roughly delineated. You know, Nathan spends a lot of time talking about expertise, and in particular these two delineations. You know, having enough relevant evidence, like, under, you know, just like knowing enough about the topic, and then being able to actually evaluate and interpret and combine the topic as well. So being able to operate in that realm. So, like, being an expert isn't just that you know a whole bunch of stuff in a field. It's that you also know how to operate in that field. And I think that that's one that we see a lot, where a lot of people can get confused. Because on some level, it's easy to know a bunch of stuff about a field. I mean, it's not always easy. But, like, I think about the number of people who go on podcasts or whatever, and they start talking about stuff that, like, that they're not necessarily an expert in, or that they're not really known for, but they sound really confident because they do know a bunch of facts about that field. But the issue is they don't really know what to do with those facts, right? They don't really know how to use them or combine them or make interesting marks. They're effectively just becoming a kind of encyclopedia. And that's not the same thing as having a real knowledge in a kind of skill, because a skill is a kind of like arte.
When people talk about studying philosophy and they're not formally inducted into it, but they think that they're versed in philosophy, I find that a lot of times philosophy becomes a matter of how many quotes do you know? Right on the first one, it's like, okay, well, what does that mean? Like, what is this context? What is the actual argument that like quote is employed in the service of, and stuff like that? They don't know that. It just sounds deep or quippy or, like, even rhetorically impressive, which is precisely what makes the epistemic trespasser a public figure, right? Is that they kind of play into particular sensibilities that someone who is not an expert is susceptible to.
You know, Noam Chomsky is kind of famous, but also controversial for the fact that, like, obviously he contributed quite a lot, particularly to, like, philosophy of language and stuff like that in a very relevant manner, and media studies and such. But he's another figure who has opinions on absolutely everything that people ask him about. But again, isn't necessarily an expert in those fields. Like, you know, he will prattle on in particular about, like, global international political issues and stuff like that. Like, he is, like, the foremost expert in all those sorts of things, when in reality, he's not even tangentially involved in those sorts of, like, disputes or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's a very distant observer.
He has a lot of books written about things like media manipulation. He's, like, ostensibly a media theorist in that regard, talking about systems of control and whatnot. It's one of those interesting cases where I do feel kind of ambivalent, not so much as far as, like, is he or is he not an expert? I am definitely, like, I guess, again, my aspiration is that if people do sit down and try to do the research, you can arrive at, you know, having, even if it's unaccredited or something like that, a certain degree of sort of rogue authority in a certain way. But at the same time, I think this paper is really good at articulating what failures of you know, epistemic credibility and ventures into epistemic trespassing look like, not just like giving pictures as far as like what the character types look like, but actually articulating what those trespasses look like. And in that regard, they do seem to, they indict a lot more than people who have aspirations like mine would be willing to entertain, right?
Yeah, and I think with, you know, with that, it's worth getting into kind of like what one of the bigger problems is, or one of the fundamental issues, which is the fact that what Nathan calls hybridized questions or hybridized issues. So this is really like the kind of the crux of the problem, or one of the main kind of pieces of trespassing, or why trespassing even happens. Most problems that people are commenting on are what Nathan calls hybridized questions or hybridized issues, which basically just means they involve more than one field of knowledge in their discussion and understanding. And it becomes a little bit of a paradox, because it's like, well, if an issue, say, actually involves four separate fields of knowledge, and you only, let's say you're really, really smart and you're an expert in two, well, you're still missing a whole bunch of the problem. So how is it possible for you to actually comment accurately on the issue?
I think this is where Nathan's quite broad call to intellectual modesty comes from, because it is the realization that, wow, like, actually, this stuff's a lot of work. You know, the world's a complicated place, and we can only get good at evaluating and interpreting so much evidence, or working with so much data, right? He does call to try to create some wiggle room by the end by talking about intellectual easement, or even like a right of way, trying to play off the trespassing metaphor, which is this idea that even if we're not necessarily experts in all of the fields where we treat hybridized questions, that doesn't mean that we can't go to the other people who are experts in those fields and like run our questions or our proposals past them and get like a, you know, kind of a feel for, are we headed in the right direction? Is this even like a plausible project and stuff like that? So it, in light of the problem being very vast, the solution, he says, is a social solution, which is to say that scholars and investigators should work together. We should sort of give up this idea of the, you know, the public intellectual, the genius that we've kind of been prompted to think makes someone really smart, and realize that the investigation of truth and trying to find solutions to the problems that we have is going to be a collaborative effort. No one's going to have all of the solutions, or no one's even going to have all of the skills to raise those questions. So it's important that when we really come down to brass tacks and realize that the problem we're dealing with is beyond our scope, we should exercise some kind of modesty and get some help as far as covering our bases for where we can't do the work ourselves. I think that's a reasonable goal, and I think it's one that is good. I'm definitely the kind of person who aspires to that unified science, right? That we really can come together and have some one coherent system. It doesn't necessarily need to come under this picture of like the single individual, though. I think that a community of scholars or a community of researchers is a perfectly reasonable goal to strive for, and it's not even one that's even less like rewarding than doing it yourself, right? Even maybe even more so.
Yeah, and I think that's a really charitable and, you know, positive in both meanings outlook, and I know that that's the direction that Nathan goes. I was thinking specifically about like philosophers in this issue of hybridization and the hybridization of knowledge. And I was thinking about like some of the kind of great philosophers and, you know, what makes them great. One kind of minor conclusion that I came to was, like, I literally wrote on my notes here for the paper, I wrote, the kind of tibidness and ambiguity of Nietzsche, or the, you know, esoteric and intermediateness of someone like Heidegger. What makes certain philosophers great in what they say? What they write has a really dense ability for interpretation. They're able to write and put things down or have put things down that can shine in all sorts of different directions depending on how the reader looks at it and how the reader chooses to interpret it. And in that sense, it's a little bit of an effective method at dealing with issues of hybridized epistemic problems. You can kind of approach work from so many different angles. It often makes the work quite like difficult, but I do think that that's kind of there. Like, this is particularly true of someone like Nietzsche, to be honest. Like, it's just this kind of like open-ended interpretive process that allows you to kind of be like, it's got a lot of flexibility in what it's claiming to know about, and therefore it can, you know, sort of be placed in one, you know, box A, B, and C, depending on how you choose to interpret the work.
Nietzsche is a good example because, I mean, he specifically calls himself a psychologist, right? He's analyzing the human soul, the human mind, and the way that it works mechanically, trying to figure out. And he's also a historian in a way, too. He's talking about how morality is a historical phenomenon that develops in a genealogy, right? So he's a good example of that single person whose works, they show that universal mark of philosophy as being able to shine a light on lots of different kinds of fields, not necessarily by trespassing, right? And in fact, it's specifically by unifying them and finding a correlation between, not just a correlation, but a co-relation, actual like core structures that are shared between those fields that allows them to unify those subject matters and to exercise similar skills, but apply that one skill to the various kinds of fields and see that they can be treated in that way, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it, by saying like not necessarily even trespassing. It's like it's that open-endedness and that flexibility that makes like the work so great. And but also too, to the other point, there's a limitation to that, right? Like the limitation is that like it the work is not necessarily super definitive, right? If you want to go and find something where you're like, okay, we've got the answer, you're not going to read Twilight of the Idols because you're like, I'm looking for the answers. You're looking for a kind of like revealing process that gets you closer and a more like holistic understanding. But I think, as you and Nathan pointed out, in a more like, you know, kind of, what's the term I'm looking for? Not logical, but the opposite of continental philosophy. In a more analytic methodology, it's that coming together of specific experts in a particular field and all saying like, okay, we're going to approach this particular problem together to get a complete holistic answer that is, you know, as relevant as possible given our current time and place and like basis of knowledge that we're all bringing to the problem, which is a little bit different than being a like kind of open-ended, flexible but highly general sweeping modality of many issues.
Yeah, I like that distinction that you drew between like a work that finds itself quite closed, like maybe a scientific study that finds some pretty concrete evidence and makes a pretty definitive recommendation.
You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I've been your host, Hale, and with me as per usual is Brandon, and we've been covering the topic of epistemic trespassing. We hope you've enjoyed this show and that you'll join us next week.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Thank you for your constant support. You help keep independent community radio alive.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.